You're listening to Around Comics, watching before Watchmen, Ozymandias number one. Welcome back to another episode of Watching Before Watchmen. I am Sal.
And I'm Braxton.
And we are looking at Ozymandias number one, written by Len Wein, with art by Jay Lee, letters by John Workman, and colors by Jun Chung, with variant covers by Phil Jimenez, Romulo Fajardo Jr., Jim Lee, with Scott Williams and Alex Sinclair. This is the, fifth number one issue from the Watching Before Watchmen. If you're not familiar with what Watching Before Watchmen is, it's basically us taking a hard look at every single issue of the Before Watchmen mega event from DC Comics and just looking at them, from the perspective of, is it good or is it bad? Not, does it hold up to the original series or is it worthy of Alan Moore's stink eye? Or any of that. It's just simply, is this a good comic book? Was it entertaining? And did it look good? And that's what we're trying to do. So this is Ozymandias number one. And I guess to jump right into it,
what'd you think?
I wasn't crazy about it. I thought artistically, I thought Jay Lee did an awesome job. I really liked how it looked. I thought he did some really interesting things with panel layouts. I thought the coloring worked really well. I thought it was a little different style for him, actually, than some of his stuff in the past.
I've never seen anything that he's done other than I had a video game. It was a Spider-Man game. That's the only thing I've ever seen of Jay Lee.
I read the Inhumans book that he had done. I read his Sentry work with Paul Jenkins. I really liked it. I'm a big fan of his stuff anyway. But this, I thought, was actually a step up for him in my eye. But writing-wise, I wasn't crazy about it. I thought the story was a little boring. I thought it didn't really bring a whole lot new to the character. And I thought in parts that it didn't logically or emotionally really make sense for this character or for his path to the eventual Ozymandias or Adrian Veidt that we see in Watchmen. And while, you know, I think we're not trying to necessarily judge this compared to Watchmen, I think, you know, it's hard to look at this character and say, okay, well, we know where he gets to. If you're going to tell an origin story, which this basically is, at least this first issue, then it should logically lead eventually to what we see in Watchmen. And I just felt like it fell flat sometimes with that. So
I liked it. I liked the art. I thought it was very daring. We see mainly it's done through narration of Veidt, and in the narration we have this dreamlike fantasy world. It doesn't seem like the real world to me. It doesn't seem like New York as it was depicted in or any of the Watchmen books.
In a weird way, it almost felt like Norman Rockwell-esque in some ways, the coloring and
I think Norman Rockwell meets Shel Silverstein.
Yeah, something like that. Well, let's jump into the actual issue itself. You know, it opens up the first couple of pages. It opens up with October 11th, 1985, and apparently right before Adrian is going to unleash his master plan on the world. That we see come to fruition in Watchmen. So he's just about getting ready to sort of start that process. He's in his Arctic fortress.
Fortress of Solitude, essentially.
And he's with Bobastis. And he starts to kind of, you know, remember or you know, think about what has led us to
this. Well, he's
this.
Recording himself.
Right, in case that he doesn't make it out alive of this plan. And he starts to sort of talk about his childhood, and that's where we see the change in art styles from a pretty basic style to this more
centered
and graphic, and he starts using circles a lot. We see circles in every page almost, either half circles or full circle panel layouts.
When he's narrating, it looks like art worthy of a mural on a window or a wall. And there's a center element to each page somewhere. But it does switch as soon as he gets into talking about how his childhood begins. And he starts off talking about how his parents were immigrants. They came over to the States.
With the threat of Nazi Germany in Europe, his parents, as soon as his mother was pregnant, his father decided that they were going to leave and come to the States so that he could have a better opportunity. And we also quickly learn that he is not your average, young boy. He, at age two, he's shows signs of brilliance. That by age four, he's reading his father's encyclopedias. And, the Adrian we know of, the brilliant genius prodigy, we see him in school and actually start to have problems in school because the teachers don't believe how smart he is. He takes an aptitude test and it's sort of off the charts and it elicits concern from the teachers. And so his father decides to tell him, you need to tone it down. Yeah, tone it down a little bit. You're too smart, and people will kind of fear that. So you need to,
another thing that happens with being the smart kid is you immediately start to get picked on by other kids. And Opie Taylor turns out to be a jerk in this book. He starts picking on him, taking his lunch, and beating him up.
Yeah, he's bullied. And before we get there, bro, I wanted to point out a couple of things in this that I saw, and I thought thematically we see it throughout the entire book almost, is there's sort of this tentacly look on some elements. There's, in his room as a boy, there's a wallpaper that's sort of a golden tentacle-looking kind of wallpaper, and then we see a poster when he's a little older, a poster on his wall, sort of a sci-fi, 50s sci-fi poster.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that, and immediately
you think of the alien at the end of Watchmen that he...
Though I don't think that he strikes me as a kid that would be way into the simple things such as science fiction and other
I don't know.
Stuff.
I think, if you look at science fiction, it's certainly fantasy, but it's also, the what could be. I mean,
he's in the Star Trek, man. He's in the...
Well, Star Trek hadn't happened yet, I don't think, at that point. But, if you look at, you talk to most astrophysicists, and not most, but a lot of...
They were into Star Trek.
They were into sci-fi and stuff, and that stuff inspired them. But, moving along, he gets picked on, he gets beat up by some older kids, a red-headed little bastard in particular, beats him up. And so he decides to go learn some kung fu from an Oriental master.
We should also mention his demeanor. He doesn't seem like... I mean, he's very, very much so portrayed as a really awkward genius, not really answering questions like a... How old is he in these pictures? Seven or eight.
Yeah, something like that.
And he doesn't seem like your typical 7 or 8 year old. So,
well, he's very cold. He's very analytical. I mean, he's
calculating as a mug.
Sure. He's brilliant. So he doesn't look at the world like your average 7 year old. So he doesn't respond to it like your average 7 year old would. He's in, as far as we know, he's the most intelligent boy alive. So. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's not going to sound or react like your average kid. But So he decides to go and learn some kung fu, and he picks it up pretty quickly, faster than anyone has ever taken. So not only is he brilliant, but he's also he has an aptitude to learn different skills, not just book smart. You know, he can actually physically he can learn something like kung fu very quickly. So he has a sort of a tactile intelligence as well. And the next time the bullies pick on him, he warns them to stay away a couple of times. And then when they won't, he unleashes a fury and blows out the kid's knee pretty bad and compound fracture. And then the rest of the bullies kind of run away in fear of Adrian. But it's not all joy. When he gets back home, he finds out that the bully's parents are upset and the school is upset and everybody's upset because of what he did. And he doesn't quite, he almost get the feeling like he doesn't understand because he was protecting himself. He warned them, he did everything right. But the sheer violence, of how he defended himself and attacked this kid, is shocking. And I think that kind of points out another thing with Adrian where, you know, he's so distant and so aloof and, you know, so sort of removed from your kind of everyday common sense that, you know, it never occurred to him not to break this kid's leg. You know, it never occurred to him to just, you know, hit him or beat him up a little bit. But it's, you know, he just...
I don't know. I mean, he warned him. So I don't think he was inclined to do it right off. He knew that, okay, look, I'm going to mess you up, but I'm giving you fair warning.
Well, no, I think I think it's the, to me, the feeling I get is that there's no empathy for him to sit there and go, well, I'm just going to beat him up a little bit. No, for him, it's, well, I'm going to use every tool that I have, and I'm going to use it most effectively.
I'm just going to go full speed on you. And it's funny you should say the empathy, because he also doesn't strike you as a kid that's being emotionally scarred from the beatings he's getting. He's a lamb, you know. You could beat on him, and he's not.
Well, I think he reacts to everything sort of like, well, it's inevitable, or it, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a surprise. You know what I mean? He knows why they're beating him because he understands them probably better than they understand themselves. So it's almost just sort of this logical response to it of going, well, of course they're going to beat me up because that's the reaction to me because they don't understand me. And so that if they fear me, and so, you know what I mean? Like, all this stuff, yeah, like a normal kid doesn't understand.
The end result being he's not your average 8-year-old kid. I mean, he's definitely aloof and, I think, emotionally detached.
Yeah, I think that just comes with that intelligence. I think, you know, if you look at, like, Robert Oppenheimer, you know, and he made the bomb but didn't really take the time to think of what would happen to it after he made it. You know, he was just so concerned with making it that he didn't think about it until, you know, then he saw what the world did with it and realized his mistake. But it was too late. And I think it's just that sort of, like, you know, single-mindedness or just detachment because of the high intelligence just kind of causes that. But so anyway, we find out, you know, the school is very upset, and his father offers to buy the school a new library if they'll kind of sweep it under the rug and not expel young Adrian, and they agree to. So we find out that his father has money. You know, we don't know how much money, but he does have money. And then from that point forward, he decides to no longer hide his gifts, and he just starts, you know, crushing it at school and ends up graduating at 14. Cum laude. And then he decides to go to postgraduate Harvard. Courses at Harvard, where he discovers his namesake and the remarkable life of Alexander of Macedonia, Alexander the Great. So he starts to become a bit obsessed with that. And during this time, we find out his parents are killed in a tragic accident. And you know, things change for him at that point. I think, you know, he decides then he want, you know, he starts kind of reflecting on, okay, well, what is my life going to become? Maybe he starts to see life is short. It can be cut short at any time. What am I doing with it? And he becomes,
well, he's, this is, you know, where his infatuation with Alexander the Great really, it's almost like his parents are gone, so that's his focus.
Maybe it's a replacement in some ways. It's some sort of father figure almost, or something more. Or it's some kind
but
of.
But it definitely it's that's it. I mean, it encompasses his whole being from that day forth, and he gives away all of his father's possessions. Or well, his
inheritance. Yeah, it's his inheritance. Yeah. He gives away his inheritance and decides that he's going to go to Turkey and retrace the steps of Alexander the Great, and he wants to do it with, you know, with from scratch, with nothing in his pocket, basically. So he goes and runs into a little trouble initially. There's some Turkish sailors or something on a dock when he comes to shore, and they kind of threaten him, and he's able to sort of just, you know, brush them off a bit with, you know, with
a
stern
them.
Warns them stern
gives
glance.
Them the creepiness.
Yeah, and this time they heed his warning and they leave
cool.
him alone. So then he starts going all over the country Orient and
tracing the steps of Alexander the Great. He continues his training. He continues his martial arts training.
He does. And during that time, he finds an acquaintance, a male acquaintance that we get a sense of, you know, and this
still,
is
still ambiguity. We don't know if
ambiguity, but I mean, it goes along with in the, you know, original in Watchmen with the hint of homosexuality to Adrian. You know, is he gay or not? And we still don't know, but it sort of, you know, adds to that a bit. But this young acquaintance gives him a ball of hashish, and tells him he'll know the right time to consume it. When he does, he starts to have visions and hallucinations, and we see this great panel, this great page of these ancient long dead pharaohs, and they're holding the head of Alexander the Great, and it's sort of this enlightening moment for Adrian where he sees that Alexander was just following their footsteps, and there were these great you know, magnificent, brilliant pharaohs that created and discovered so much before that, and now he, you know, we see
Wait
him.
Wait a minute, who came first, the pharaohs or Alexander the Great?
Well, I'm not a historian, but I believe it would be the pharaohs. Would be long before.
I have to take a world history class just to understand this vision.
But I think what's important with it, you know, is that it's sort of
hit
a turning,
the lineage.
Well, I think it's a turning point for him, where now
he's the next
great pharaoh, and his destiny is now not necessarily to conquer the world like Alexander, or travel the world, but to rule it and, you know, shape it in his image. I think. And also, I think, you know, it's interesting that he mentions two different pharaohs.
Ptolemy and Eratosthenes.
I'm glad you said them. And how they were both sort of scientific men. And I think that's important to
because he does go down the road
I mean,
of science and his world conquering.
Right.
Of himself.
So after that, he decides to leave, and he goes back through Turkey, and he runs into the same gang of seamen or longshoremen.
He runs into the same bit of seamen
on the shore
docks.
And this time they don't heed his warning. They jump him, and he proceeds to beat the crap out of all of them. And then upon returning to New York, you know, he decides that he needs to make a fortune if he is going to, you know, meet his destiny. So he starts studying the financial news and the stock market, and he has a small nest egg that he begins to invest and starting to do very well with it. And in the meantime, he meets this young girl named Miranda in a Gunga diner, which, you know, we're familiar with the Gunga diners. And she kind of pushes her way into his existence, even though he kind of brushes her off at first, doesn't really want anything to do with her. But they end up sleeping together and spending time together. And
yeah, I don't know if he sees her as just a distraction or, you know, I guess an attempt at having to have some sort of a semblance of a normal life. I don't know why he...
He's very dismissive of her the whole time. He's not.
She's real playful, real flirty.
Yeah, and he's very serious. And, you know, he's very he's been very serious since he was 2 years old, it seems like. He's very focused on what he wants to do. And human beings seem to kind of fall into a, you know, into a, it's okay if they're there as long as they don't get in my way. You know, and we can kind of see a little bit of that.
Well, and his duty to humanity, which we need to, I guess, get into his whole motivation sooner or later, because what is he trying to do at this point? Is he wanting to better the world?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we can assume from Watchmen that that's his ultimate goal, that he feels like the world is going down a very dark path, that it's going to I mean, there was the fear of nuclear war, and Adrian felt like it was inevitable that sooner or later that the world would destroy itself through nuclear holocaust, and so he was trying to find a way to stop that, whatever the cost. And he figured that no matter what happened, even if he killed half the population, it would still be better than the complete destruction of the planet. So I think his intentions are good, but I think that his own narcissism gets in the way, and I think he has a bit of, you know, he's a bit of a sociopath at the same time, that he doesn't have, you know, like we talked about earlier, doesn't have that empathy of other people. He doesn't,
I don't know. I don't know if sociopath is the correct. I have to look at sociopath. I always thought it was more of a he has a god complex or something.
Well, that would be.
And I don't know. Maybe that's the same. Maybe it's the same thing. But I always thought you murdered people when you were a sociopath.
Well, he did.
Well, I know, but I mean, he murdered people to make the world a better place. I mean.
Well, sociopath is like someone who lacks social conscious. I mean, normally you're talking about
the seeing the meaning of life and the importance of life, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe it's not the perfect, you know, psychological definition for him, but I think that he, in some sense, like he doesn't have a social conscience because he doesn't he feels that his ideas are more important than human life. And so whether it's like someone going out and shooting somebody while they're robbing a 7-Eleven because they don't care, they're just trying to get cash, it's the ends justify the means, you know what I mean? And so I don't think it's regardless of whether those ends are intentional, you know, your intentions are positive or negative. You're still not regarding human life as something precious and you know, should be protected. Even though he is trying to protect it, ultimately, you know, it's almost, is he trying to protect human life, or is he trying to protect his own life? Ultimately?
As we're going along, I'm really starting to think he's going to be the hardest one to write, simply because, I mean, where's he coming from? Is he a good guy as Ozymandias, or is he completely rotten on the inside, looking out for himself?
I don't think it's that black or white. I think he's complex. I agree that he would be very difficult to write because, you know, he's supposed to be the smartest man in the world. How do you write the smartest man in the world? We've talked about that, you know, on Around Comics. Have talked about it. Like, how do you write Reed Richards? If you're not a brilliant, you know, scientist, if you don't understand you know, astrophysics and, you know, all the math and all that, you know what I mean? If you're not thinking of that level of a character you're writing, it can be difficult to do. Like, how do you, you know, you can't just throw out big words or, like, you know, just sort of make him try and sound smart. I think it goes beyond that. I think in some ways Ween has done a good job with that because he has stayed aloof and disconnected. So that helps, that cold intellectual kind of Spock-ish kind of behavior. Yeah. But, you know, the fact that he chose to write this basically from Adrian's memory and from his narrative makes it that much more difficult. But I don't know. I mean, that's, and you know, the thing with the original 12 issues of Watchmen and with Adrian is that that's sort of the question is, was he right? Was he justified or was he wrong? Was he a good guy or was he a bad guy? It's not answered. I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, that's the point of Watchmen is that all these characters are flawed. All of them are good and bad. All of them have good intentions and make bad mistakes and nobody's perfect. But there's no answers to it. The world, I mean, I think, you know, that was sort of Alan Moore's point to some degree, that superheroes are very black and white. You have good guys and bad guys. The world is not black and white. There aren't just simply good guys and simple bad guys. It doesn't work that way. And that's sort of the whole point with Adrian is, like, was he justified? Was he doing the right thing? You know, saving the world by killing, you know, 30 million people. If you save billions, you know,
by killing
a million, is it worth it? And that's a very age-old sort of philosophical quandary. You know, there is no right answer to it. There's no wrong answer. There's just your answer. What would you do? So, right. You know.
Well, let's see what he does. Because, you know, that all plays into his decisions on the next couple of things that happen here.
Well, we see, you know, yeah, he's getting to know this girl Miranda, and while he sort of keeps her at a distance,
successful, by the way. He's made his fortune.
He's made his fortune. We see now he's starting to build his empire, build his symbol, which is his tower. We see the beginning construction of his tower, and he's very focused on that. Miranda sort of is still trying to be a part of his life. And he tolerates her, but he doesn't seem like he likes her. You know, not that he doesn't like her, but he just, you know, he's got more important
things.
Yeah,
she's young, you know, she wants to go out and stuff, and he's focused on his internal mission.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess right now at this point, he's just wanting to amass power, and once he gets there, then it's not clearly defined just yet. But.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know at this point, he even knows yet. His ultimate, you know, sort of plan. I don't think it's come necessarily yet.
Yeah.
I mean, the specter of nuclear war would be around at this time, but would it?
Yeah, it's,
you know,
we're not. We don't know that
we don't know
he has any clear intentions. But she goes out, and he gives her a wad of cash, and we're in the 70s, right? So how much money do you think that is?
I don't know, $3,000
maybe.
$5,000 yeah,
right
something
there.
Like that. It's a lot of money.
She takes it in a hug.
Unless it's like, you know, a fake band. He's like 100 on the outside and a bunch of singles.
You think he would do her that way?
I don't know, maybe.
Get out of here.
Well, yeah, she wants to go out, and he says, well, here, just take some cash and go have a good time without me, thinking that that's, you know, will appease her. But she decides to then kind of go, and I think almost in sort of spite of you know, his dismissal of her, she goes to a seedy underground club and runs into a pimp named Moloch, who we're familiar with. And Moloch, as pimps are wont to do, immediately tries to turn her out with a little... little, as the pimps would say.
Yeah.
With a little heroin, a little H, a little horse. He offers it to her. He tells her the first taste is free, and she
takes it back to the apartment.
Yeah, takes it back. Where Adrian shows up and finds her, thinking that she's sleeping, but then we see that she's in fact overdosed and she is dead. She is gone. Which really upsets Adrian. And I was kind of confused by this because, you know, up to this point, we've seen that he really has zero emotions about anything. I mean, whether it was getting beat up as a kid by bullies, whether it was his parents dying, whether it was, you know, being attacked by Turkish seamen. You know, he hasn't really shown any emotion.
If Turkish semen doesn't upset you, then
you have no heart.
You have no heart. But I just noticed that, yeah, he is. He's crying on the next page.
It certainly looks that way. Yeah, I mean, yeah, red eyed, and he's very upset about it. And that felt very, like, it didn't have the proper emotional context to me. Like, it didn't feel logical, or it didn't feel.
Well, we didn't really feel like she. He was close to her, but I guess he was. I mean, he really loved her, or he.
I guess, but I don't know. I'm not convinced of that.
You're not convinced.
Well, what would
Sal's not convinced.
I'm not convinced. What would make more sense to me? And they, you know, well, in the beginning, when he first finds her body, he starts thinking about, like, the bad publicity of his company, and that can't.
Which seems more like the vibe that I would.
Right. And so I thought he was actually going to, like, hide her body and cover it all up or something for the greater good. You know, he's got his plan and he can't let something like this get in the way. Well, she probably did in as well, but they don't say it. Yeah. But instead, he gets upset about it and decides that he's going to put on a costume and become a vigilante and go out and get revenge for her death.
Didn't like that part.
Specifically, I did not like. I thought that up until this point, I thought the story was okay. It was a little boring. You know, nothing all that interesting to me pulled out from Adrian. But okay, it was going along, and I enjoyed the art very much so. But this to me just felt like. Very cliched, sort of like, you know, it didn't make any sense. Like, why all of a sudden would this send him in that direction? Like,
I would have thought that Ozymandias would have been, you know, something he created, like, in tandem with his discovery and infatuation with Alexander the Great. And, you know, this is who I'm going to be, you know, like when he had the vision, perhaps.
Well,
and he realized that he was going to be the next great leader, then he would use Ozymandias as the.
I would think the guy that is pretty much, you know, planned out his entire ascension to, you know, greatness, in minute detail, would. Not just like at the drop of a hat because a woman who apparently didn't really care that much about overdosed on drugs, and that would just send him in this in completely different path than what he had been planning his entire life. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a departure from everything he was. You know, he's got everything planned out. This is his eye is on the prize. He's focused on, you know, where he has to get.
We're seeing that he. What we know about him isn't actually what we know about him. I mean, he's emotional. He gets upset, and he loved Miranda, he's doing this crazy thing because of it.
But
I guess maybe he's incorporating Ozymandias as best he can into the plan, but by God, he's going to avenge her, you know, whatever.
Well, and to me, that just is a terrible choice as a writer to all of a sudden throw this in. It falls flat. It does not feel believable to me at all. For everything that we've seen in this character in this book so far, there's no pathos for it. Like, it doesn't make any sense for him to all of a sudden make that decision and all of a sudden be emotional and let those emotions rule and overrule everything that he's been trying to do. It made no sense whatsoever to me. For him to all of a sudden just do this for no apparently logical reason whatsoever.
I'm okay with it. I don't think you're as whizzed off about it as maybe Night Owl, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Night Owl was a disaster.
This isn't the affront that Night Owl was to us, but I'm fine with it, the story. I'll go along with this. Again, I thought that maybe Ozymandias might have been something he would have adopted earlier on, but that doesn't matter.
Well, I think it does matter, though. I think that it really tears a little bit away from the character and what we feel like, you know, the great and powerful Ozymandias would do, and how that character came to be. Like to me, it just sort of like really undermines now.
Well, you think that he's not prone to ever having any emotion, but I'm going with Lin Wein's nudge that, okay, look, this guy has, and which really makes him scarier. If he can break down and if he's not this completely Spock-like, logical, everything has its place character, and he's fallible and he could break with emotional and adopt this.
Okay, but you had like 20 pages to show one hint at that. Just maybe if you did, just if it was done well, all you would have to do is one hint that he has some sort of emotional, you know, ability in him to let emotion override him. Show that one time somewhere earlier in the story, and this moment is not nearly as hollow. But you didn't. You showed the complete opposite of it.
Well, maybe Lin Wein in the next issues, he's going to play up the fact that Ozymandias is, for most intents and purposes, is logical, but every once in a while he has this fierce.
Why are you such an apologist? Why are you such an apologist for Lin Wein?
I'm not an apologist.
You are. You totally are.
You're not talking me into it. Is what I'm saying. I'm okay with it.
All right. Well, you know.
Let me say something about the art. I mean, the art, I thought was.
Well, hold on. Before we just finish the story. I mean, he ends up putting on a Halloween costume and picking like bits and pieces from his trophy room. And creating this persona,
creates Ozymandias,
and he's going to go out and find justice for Miranda. And
we should
that's
also
how the
point
issue
out
ends.
That Moloch, I mean, you know, he's not a real menacing bad guy, even as he was portrayed in Watchmen. I mean, and as he appeared in The Comedian, he just strikes me as, I mean, is that the best bad guy that this universe has to offer? Is Moloch? But
well, I don't know. I just think he's just the character that keeps, you know, popping up. I think there were certainly other, you know, bad guys, but I don't know that there were, you know. I mean, think of it this way. Most of the time, like, straight-up crooks are just doing it because they want, you know, they need the money, or they feel like they deserve the money, or, you know what I mean? Like,
so you think that the supervillain is a flawed concept anyway?
Oh, absolutely. Like the Lex Luthor, like super genius that wants.
I'll go with that.
I think that was part of Alan Moore and David
Gibbons. He
didn't want
to concentrate on that kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, it was like there would just be. Because the superheroes are flawed, so the super villains are flawed. They're not like, you know. And really, I mean, Adrian is that Lex Luthor. You know, Adrian is Lex Luthor. He is that genius intellect that thinks that he has the answers to humanity's salvation, and doesn't care about the cost. I mean, that was really the Lex Luthor that, to me, was the most dangerous. And that's always like the villain who believes that what he's doing is for the greater good. You know, Hitler thought what he was doing was best for Germany and best for his people. You know, it's that sociopath part of it that, you know, gets in the way and kind of makes him go a little over the top with it sometimes. But go ahead with did you like the art? Did you
I loved it. I thought the art was again, I'm going to find it, I'm interested to see if Jai Lee continues this you know, the real centered mural circular panel layout in parts of the story that are not a flashback, or
you mean all the O's for Ozymandias that he used?
I don't think that they're.
I think they're all O's. It's all O O O O O.
You either have a rectangle.
There's O's everywhere. Nobody uses O's. Circles. Who uses circles in panel layouts?
Well, just because
It's all O's.
You don't
O's.
Have that many choices. It doesn't mean that it's an O for Ozymandias.
O, 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 O. It's all O's.
I think the O actually, the circle is representative of the single eye on the alien.
Maybe. Well, going back to that, there were a couple of things like thematically through the book.
Yeah,
that
you
I
thought that there's a lot of tentacles and stuff represented.
There's tentacles everywhere.
That's Jay Lee's art. I don't think that. I think the tentacles just come with the package, man.
This was a lot of tentacles. This was more tentacles than normal. And you had the poster in his room of the one-eyed tentacle monster.
Well, that
was
obvious, a little foreshadowing or whatever.
You had tentacles on his wallpaper in the house, all over the house.
Did you feel claustrophobic at any because of the art?
I didn't feel claustrophobic. I mean, you were saying that you felt like it put you in a box kind of thing.
A little bit in a box. Now, that's just a little bit. I kind of felt a little bit in a box, but
I thought it was more representative of sort of.
I wouldn't trade it off for it. I think it was still worth doing.
I think it was more like the order of Adrian's mind. We're seeing this story through.
Yeah, I think that it serves that, and it does. So
we see it through his O, and then we see his very ordered and centered mind, and you also see him, like panel after panel or page after page after page. It's like Adrian's dead center, in the page, because the world revolves around him. You know what I mean? He's so narcissistic.
Well,
the
story's about him.
Well, the story's about him, but you can tell stories and still, and I think that goes to his character is like. He's so distant and detached from, normal empathy of human beings that there is nobody else but him in his world. I don't think anyone even exists, in the world other than him and what he believes is the most important thing. And that makes sense to me, but I didn't get a claustrophobic. I got a very ordered, a very sort of, everything's in its place, and it's very, very.
Yeah, he was the right artist, most definitely.
I thought it was a little different than his earlier stuff. I really liked it. I love the color.
I've got to look for his other stuff.
Check out Inhumans. Inhumans is pretty cool. But I love the colorist. I thought the colors were great. It gave it a very, kind of old.
I thought the coloring was fucking bullshit.
What? Seriously?
I thought the colors was fine.
You're just being
just trying to move you on to the last two pages.
Oh, you're done. That's it. You're done talking about.
Guess.
So you liked it?
I did. I liked it. I thought that. I thought it was. I mean, it's not. It didn't keep me. It didn't. Flip my skirt up and show my rear to the world. But it's. It was serviceable. It was good.
Was it entertaining?
It was entertaining.
I thought it was kind of boring. I thought it was, if you're going to make the choice, and with this whole Watchmen thing or before Watchmen thing, I think that's all, I'm very interested in what decisions the writers are making to tell what stories. Like, where are we going to pull out the moment in time to tell a story? And I think some of them have done a really good job of picking interesting moments or interesting, stories to tell. And like we talked about before, I think, you could tell a whole story that happens in a day in the life of this character. It doesn't have to be some epic origin of this character. But if you're going to make the decision to tell the origin, which Len Wein did in this, I think, one, you have to kind of live up to, okay, where does this character get to? Because we see the end result. We see how they end up. So if you're going to tell a story of how they began, it has to me, make sense that they get to that place in Watchmen. And I thought I thought sometimes he did a good job of that, but I thought it was kind of safe in some ways, too. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff here. There wasn't a whole lot of, brave or bold decisions made on what he was going to talk about or decide this is what made Adrian the person that he was. And then I just thought it was kind of boring. I just thought it was, it was a travel log in a lot of ways. It was just sort of like, oh, I'm here, and then I'm going there, and then I'm going there, and then I'm going there, and it's, you know, nothing that, it wasn't anything that we hadn't really seen before, I thought. And then like the moment at the end with Miranda and him turning, you know, the defining moment in his life, the one of the most defining moments in his life, is done sort of on a whim.
Well, if we wasn't limited to 22 pages to tell this story, I feel like if Lin-Wein wanted to do anything else to help, certainly to help sell you on the notion, would be to elaborate, maybe have some scenes where Adrian, you know, kind of starts to fall for Miranda, maybe. And then we see,
but I think the problem with
break
that
and do something totally out of character and totally, you know, hey, the most interesting thing about Spock was what? When we saw, you know, we saw a little bit of emotion, any story,
yeah,
where
but the difference
came through.
But the difference was that was built up over time. That was played out, you know, like you.
Well, we've got time with this character. That's,
yeah, but nothing changed. Like, he was stoic, crazy emotional. That makes no sense. You know what I mean? Like, there was never any moment in time in the first 20 pages of the book, and there were plenty of opportunities to do so. But there was not one moment.
If he had five more relationship pages, he would have.
Come on, that's bullshit. He's got the pages to work in. He could have done it easily enough. I think
with the Miranda relationship, he would have sold you on.
I don't need five pages of a relationship to see someone has emotion or not. He had 20 pages leading up to it to give me any bit of emotion whatsoever, and he didn't give me one. So then, when the character does have emotion, he didn't even show emotion when his parents died. But this redhead he meets in a diner.
Love. Redheaded love.
He wasn't in love. He didn't show any facet of love. There was not one
maybe
inkling.
Maybe it's the 90 and he knows that he's never going to.
You're a puss. You just cannot fucking say something negative about it. It's terrible.
Well, I told you the art made me feel claustrophobic. I mean, that's a negative.
The only good thing in the damn book is the art, and you're saying negative stuff about that, but the story was good. No.
Well, I felt like the world, when I say claustrophobic, maybe that's not the right description. I feel like
you just
it's
can't handle
such a fantasy world, his past, the way that Jai Li illustrates it in this panel layout, that is such a fantasy world that it's almost maybe it doesn't exist or it,
well, it's,
you know,
memory.
It's
it only
like in a box or something. It's, you know, it's, we're looking through a little magical ornate window at all of these images. But again, I'm okay with that because this is his memories, and, you know,
we
if
all
it's
see
your
memories.
We can, yeah, we can, you can play around with images and what have you.
But the story, but the story was great.
Yeah, I'm all right with the story.
Nah, boo. All right, well.
Maybe the next one.
I thought the story was subpar.
Ish.
It was my second least favorite so far of the
I'm with you on that first one.
Yeah, the first one was terrible. But, all right, well, then we got the two pages of the backup story, the pirate story. We see in this, at the end of the last one, we saw that our hero is...
Yeah, we saw Raleigh coming up out of the water. We thought it was going to be this crazy...
You wanted it to be some sort of...
Supernatural. Oh, my God, he's a ghost.
I never thought that.
Ghost water face.
No, I didn't see it. I never assumed that.
Well, he kind of looked like he was one with the water. But anyway, we see that it's Great White that's giving
him
the old Quint treatment.
The old Quint treatment.
Yeah, chowing down on him.
You fine Spanish ladies, farewell and adieu.
Like swimming with bow-legged women.
It was a Great White, and it bursts through the water, and we see half of Raleigh's, half the man he once was, and the shark then comes and attacks our guy, but he's lucky enough to crack off a shard of wood or something and stab it in the shark's eye. And the shark
sinks to its doom.
And somehow it's killed by getting stabbed in the eye. I'm not sure how that...
Yeah, you get stabbed in the eye. Let's see how you fare.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Whoever wrote this doesn't know anything about sharks, because the first... Well, no, like a shark, when it attacks, it rolls its eyes in the back of its head to protect them from sharp objects. So...
I thought that... Well, we're not going to argue. You're trying to get me into a shark argument, and I'm not biting.
Well, that's... You can look that up. That's the truth. They roll their eyes in the back of their heads so that... You know.
So
don't you remember from Jaws? He rolls its white eyes or whatever.
The end of this story does not have the...
And then you stab it in the eye and it dies? Why would it die?
You can't see anymore, man.
All right.
No point to live. Can't see. So the end of the story doesn't have near the cliffhanger. I mean...
No, he's just
the
floating.
The past three, you're getting drugged to the bottom of the drink by a cannon. You're got some crazy ghost face coming out of the water. Now we're just kind of...
floating.
We're floating.
Well, maybe it'll be a huge, crazy something the next time.
You don't like this story, right? You don't...
I'll
just kind of in for the...
I'll be completely honest with you. The original Tales of the Black Freighter was my least favorite part of Watchmen.
Too.
So... Yeah. Yeah, this is just sort of like bringing up bad memories of that, almost.
And an extension of the duty.
I mean, I read it because I understood like it was part of the story, and as I kind of realized that it was, an analog in some ways for the fear of nuclear war, and it related to the main story, but it didn't. It wasn't. I didn't find it terribly enjoyable as a read. I don't know. Pirate comics has never been something I really liked anyway. I like pirate movies, but pirate comics, I don't know.
You like Pirates of Penzance?
Sure. I was in Pirates of Penzance in junior high. I was a sailor in Pirates of Penzance.
Okay, I'm just going to admit to the audience that Sal wanted me to bring up Pirates of Penzance so that he could bring up the fact that he played
a sailor. Yeah.
I was a muleteer in... Man of La Mancha.
Oh, very nice. I was the tortoise in Tortoise and a Hare. That was like grade school, though. I'm trying to think of any other plays I was in.
I was in another play, but it was not a... Somebody wrote it.
They always kind of made me go into plays because I could sing.
Yeah, I hear that about you. I need to listen. I need to get some...
I had the voice of an angel as a young man. I was...
Well, you have now. You're a good narrator for the show.
But funny enough, I had a very high voice as a child, a singing voice. I didn't have a high speaking voice, but I had a very high singing voice. I had a very high range. I was a soprano.
I can't believe you were a soprano.
Yeah, up until high school, I was a soprano. And even today, I can sing pretty high. My natural singing voice is actually higher than... It's not a soprano any longer, but yeah, I was... Yeah, that's why they made me in all the frickin' plays, because I could sing,
Well, what can you sing right now?
Nothing, I don't know.
Come on, we had...
I'm not singing on...
The past episode, we had this, the crazy Walter voice.
We had Walter...
You know what, you shouldn't have done Walter. You should have done
singing correspondence?
Yeah, something like that.
No, I haven't sang anything in a long time. My voice is pretty raw from talking so much tonight, but...
That's even better. You can sing the blues now.
I could definitely sing the blues.
Well, that's it, folks. That's Ozymandias, and that is Before Watchmen.
And it was not so good, in my opinion. Thumbs down for me. What do you say, sir?
Oh, man, what did they do when... They didn't. They were indifferent.
I think they fought a lot.
I'm not going thumbs up. I'm going. You know what? I'm going to go thumbs up because the art was really good.
Art was very good. I would say yeah.
You don't have a full down. You got kind of like a gangsta thumb.
Gangsta thumb. Like when you're like
on
you're
the
holding
side.
You're holding the pistol sideways.
A lateral thumb.
The dumbest
Sal's
way.
Sal's got a lateral thumb on his.
Lateral thumb. It's hanging low though. It's kind of pointing down a little bit, like three quarters of the way, not full. I wasn't horrible. It wasn't Night Owl bad, but it was. I thought it was safe and boring.
No, it was not Night Owl bad.
One moment was really bad. The moment of him like deciding to become Ozymandias for no apparent reason, I felt was really bad. I thought that was a terrible writing choice by Len Wein. But other than that, it was okay. Wasn't great. You know, what are you going to do? It's not worth $4.
Well, we got to read the next one.
Yeah, we do. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. That was Watching Before Watchmen, Ozymandias number one. Please remember you can always send us emails at info@aroundcomics. You can follow us on Twitter @aroundcomics or @BrianSalazar. That's Brian with an O. Or @Braxton9, BRAXTON number nine.
Don't forget the X.
Someone did that. You can go to our website, www.aroundcomics.com, and you can leave comments, or we have a forum, and every episode has its own thread. You can go in there and just lay into us. Tell us you loved Ozymandias and we're fools, or at least I am, for not liking it. Or agree with me and be really smart and say, I'm an awesome guy like you, and I agree that it was terrible and badly written. That's pretty much
it. Yeah, come to the forum because we've got some real interesting – one guy, Frost, is really bringing us up to speed on some of these things that we don't even cover or consider.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'd love to hear. I mean, we're certainly not – you know, I mean, my memory is too bad to remember everything from Watchmen and all this stuff. I try and do some research, but let's be honest, folks. I have a life. I have, you know, work and – stuff like that. I can only do so much research for this stuff, you know. So.
And I'm Southern, so I mean, you know, I've got that old thing going. So it's we phone everything in, you know.
But yeah, please come to the site and tell us what you think. And I think that's it. We're
good
done.
Good night.
Good evening. We need something better than good night. Good night is.
Let's just tell everybody we love them.
No.
I love you.
No.
Right,
no, right, stop saying that. How about like adios, muchachos?
I thought you were gonna say adios, motherfuckers.
Adios, motherfuckers. No. That I like that actually. Adios, motherfuckers. And that's it.
That sounds violent. Oh my god.
That's all right. I think that's it. So thank you all for listening. Adios, motherfuckers.
I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.